department stores. And early on, he began working on the production aspects of Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and Mork and Mindy, for those of you who are as old as I am. He moved into film production primarily in the second Star Trek film, and before long, he became executive producer of Star Trek IV and was the producer for both 5 and 6 for you Trekkies out there. Over the last 10 years, he has been exceptionally busy. Apart from sending and supporting both of his children at Whitworth College, Beth and Ben, both met their spouses here, he has produced such major films as Mighty Joe Young, Inspector Gadget, Left Behind, X-Men, Planet of the Apes, Fantastic Four, Visitation, X-Men The Last Stand, and the most recent Fantastic Four. He is currently working on Wolverine in Australia, which is the prequel to the X-Men film. As he has become successful in Hollywood, Ralph has never shied away from talking about the larger cultural issues associated with his craft. He's been frequently asked to reflect on how his Christianity informs his vocation, as well as the larger issues of tension between Christianity and Hollywood. Tonight, he will share some film clips. It's a Freudian slip. Film clips, some thoughts, reflection about how he perceives the art of storytelling to be unfolding and some of the challenges of being a Christian in Hollywood. He will talk and show clips for about an hour and then be open to some questions and answers. Please join me in welcoming Ralph Winter.
Thanks very much. It's very nice. I hope you feel that way in an hour. Well, we're going to play with some technology here and run clips from a bunch of different things. First one I'm going to run from my computer. I don't know if you saw the movie Brokeback Mountain, but certainly you've seen something in the Back to the Future movies. So see what this is. I love that clip because, you know, it comes out of the love of storytelling, the love of using the tools that are so available. We enjoy retelling stories. And what I love about this is how the subtext changes what those stories are about. ripping shots of two guys from three different movies, and with that structure of the movie trailer, giving it a whole different meaning or suggesting that there's a whole different meaning. Well, I'm fascinated with the tools of storytelling and how it connects with audiences. And I think that's why you're coming here tonight and this week about dialoguing about some of these tools and how this works. Well, how do we know what kinds of stories connect with an audience? And whether or not we understand the specific tools that we use as filmmakers, many know its power and its impact. When that clip was on the internet 2 years ago, it's the kind of thing that inspired the Academy to spoof their own movies at the Oscars. And no doubt Facebook or YouTube will find something else that'll help the Oscars keep it lively this year. I want to make some observations about storytelling and how we understand stories. And I want to start with the way Jesus told stories, the parables, in particular the prodigal son. What better place to start? Much has been written about the prodigal son, including many books, and it's a great example of storytelling, and it lasts. It's lasted all these years. I won't read the passage because I assume most of you in the room are familiar with the parable. But here's some observations about it. Number one, I think Jesus knew who his audience was. He knew what he was going to say was going to irritate the religious professionals in the crowd. They all knew the social implications of what was going on, and the story was carefully crafted for that audience. He knew that others might be stimulated to think of the story at another level, that of the father and son and the family interactions. But the story works, and it soaks in at different levels. Second observation is that Jesus understood subtext. All great storytelling in movies conveys meaning through the subtext. Look at that first clip. That subtext is completely different. That's what makes you laugh. Jesus knew the religious professionals would identify with the older brother in the story of the parable of the prodigal son. The subtext of following the rules and doing what is right. The indignation of the younger brother's faults. And Jesus doesn't draw conclusions. He leaves it open. The deeper subtext, of course, is that it's not about the son, but about the father. This should be called the parable of the prodigal or wasteful father. It's the father who's outrageous in his behavior, wasting his resources on both sons who don't seem to care. And who does the father represent? Of course, it's God. In one sense, parables are never about God. In another sense, they're always about God and the kingdom. They're told about a manager in a field with his employees or servants who bury their talents, but ultimately they're about God and his kingdom. Rarely are the parables about the church or the church community directly, but they're everyday things, everyday situations. And we study them as followers of Christ to find meaning in the subtext, how these things, these common things, might shed light on who God is. And great teaching and preaching brings out those elements and make us go further, go back wanting to reread the original text. And here's a third observation. I think the story that Jesus tells is dark. The younger son tells the father he wants him dead so he can have his money. He eats with pigs, squanders his money. Even the fatted calf finds a violent end to its purpose sooner than expected. The darkness is intriguing, and it draws the audience in. Why didn't the church fathers call this the parable of a loving father? It's not as interesting. And Jesus told a story that has an unhappy ending. Not all the loose ends are tied up. They have some serious family therapy to go through at the end of this. The eldest brother is still angry. There's no conclusions. There's more darkness to follow in this story. It makes me think of the hymn with the words, "He breaks the power of canceled sin." If the sins are canceled, why is there still power? There's more darkness that follows in this that Jesus leaves open-ended. There's no justice in this story. The ending doesn't seem fair. No one deserves what he or she gets. Well, when I reflect on these observations about this parable, I think we don't tend to look at parables looking for these kinds of characteristics. As a matter of fact, we'd rather not point them out. Sometimes the images are too jarring or disturbing, and we've softened the story of the prodigal son and missed some of the power of the story. And as a result, quite often our Christian faith, our Christian films, and our filmmakers and our art doesn't always know its audience or the power of subtext. And we avoid darkness, and we insist on happy endings, and we rob our viewers of how light can shine in the darkness and overcome it. And we usually end up with pious trash, with fabricated stories that have cardboard characters never really connecting with an audience. Jesus says this in Mark 9. On the other hand, if you give one of these simple, childlike believers a hard time bullying or taking advantage of their simple trust, you'll soon wish you hadn't. I'm reading from the Message. You'd be better off dropped in the middle of a lake with a millstone around your neck. If your hand or your foot gets in God's way, chop it off and throw it away. You're better off maimed or lame and alive than the proud owner of two hands and two feet, godless in a furnace of eternal fire. If your eye distracts you from God, pull it out, throw it away. You're better off one-eyed and alive than exercising your 20/20 vision from inside the fires of hell. Graphic images and a warning. Kind of reads like an episode of The Sopranos. And if you think about it, most of the parables are dark. Most of the stories in the Bible are dark. The Good Samaritan makes me think of the LA riots, a black man who saves a white truck driver after being attacked and hit with bricks. The story of Hosea, a guy who knowingly pursues a prostitute to be his wife. It makes me think of the book Redeeming Love. The story of Job. What if an American president had someone killed for his benefit? Would that be dark? It's the story of David. What do you think about people sold into slavery, a very current story today? The story of Joseph. Even the story of Noah and the Ark is so dark we relegate it to kids. It's easier to handle. It's easier to understand. God destroying the earth is too jarring. Heaven Almighty was meant to be funny last summer. But underneath it has the same kind of darkness that Galactus brings to the earth in the Fantastic Four movies. Yet I think the original text talks about hitting reset on the hard drive. We naturally want to minimize those darker stories. There's the old Sunday school joke when the 9-year-old comes home and his mom says, "So what'd you learn in Sunday school today?" "Oh, Mom, it was great. The teacher told us about how God sent Moses behind the enemy lines on a rescue mission to get the Israelites out of Egypt. Got to the Red Sea, he had his engineers build a pontoon bridge. All the people walked across safely. He used his forward-looking radar and GPS to call in an airstrike. They send in bombers to blow up the bridge and all the Israelites were saved." Now, Mom says, "Now, Joey, your teacher didn't tell you that." "Mom, if I told you what they told me, you wouldn't believe it." As we grow up, we find Jesus to be a fairly difficult person to understand. He looks into dark places for the one lost sheep out of the hundred. He calls his boldest disciple Satan. He furiously cleans the temple. He tells ambiguous parables that confuse even his closest followers. And Jesus attracts huge crowds only to perplex them by telling them to eat his flesh and drink his blood. It's kind of dark. I'm proud of the fact that in X-Men, Nightcrawler was just one of the many dark characters. Here's a character that looks like the devil, has a tail, quotes scripture, and he's not made fun of by his friends. Dark stories are okay. We need mystery and transcendence. And only with some of those elements can we truly be revolutionary. I want to show you that clip from X2. It's okay. We've got some projectors and we're playing with it. It's okay. Perfect. The player falls asleep. Shall we just move on? What do you think? All right, we'll wait a moment.
No.
This is what happens when you plan everything out, everything's ready to go, and then the machinery decides to go to sleep to conserve energy. And what's popping the other machine? Yeah. Got to load for a minute to get past all the FBI warnings here. Thank you. That's good. It was last Christmas or the Christmas before that Nativity came out, and I had high hopes for what it might do. And so did New Line Cinema, the studio that released the picture. But instead of telling the story in its original context, they follow the same pattern that many Christians follow and told the story right down the middle, thinking that was what the audience wanted and they would somehow tap into the passion audience. There were no sharp edges to offend anyone and no hooks to really bring a new audience in either. To me, a narrator is never a good sign in a visual storytelling medium, although you might get away with it once in a while. Angels who appear in freshly laundered tunics with styled haircuts just take the edge off it for me. The director did capture the bond between the two teenagers against the world, believing what God had told them and boldly following where their faith would take them. And that was compelling. But a couple things I take away from my filmmaking from watching that movie and hoping it would connect a classic story for today's audience to embrace. As I said earlier, I don't think you can be afraid of the dark. What a brutal time where a dictator decides to murder all the male children under the age of 2. Not that we need to see graphic stabbing and violence, but the impact on families and communities of that terror was only touched on. Any roughness was sanded smooth so as not to offend anyone, but it doesn't grab anyone either. And where's the sense of mystery in our storytelling? Franco Zeffirelli in Jesus of Nazareth 30 years ago makes the story of the angel coming to Mary intriguing. Mary's awakened in a room by a bright light outside the wooden window shutters. And we observe a one-sided conversation she has with another person, unseen, powerful. We don't need to explain every word. Mel Gibson deliberately made the passion in another language, so you would have to pay attention to the screen. Our Catholic brothers and sisters are far ahead of us in telling visual stories and doing with mystery. Make a list and compare the great Catholic storytellers of the last century, Hitchcock, Ford, Frank Capra, Francis Ford Coppola, Scorsese, De Palma, Gibson, and then the Protestant list. Until the Reformation, the world learned the gospel through the stories etched on the walls of the great cathedrals. Words are important, but well-told, theologically grounded stories told with mystery and intrigue last longer in our imaginations. And what of raising our stories to another level, stories that take us beyond the literal and become transcendent? We all have our list of movies that make us think and dream for bigger things. How can we take our art to that level? Again, what makes the passion so powerful was those images that went far beyond the plot of the story. The Caravaggio paintings and juxtaposed images stuck out and made us reflect on what this story is really about. The Nativity had the raw material right in front of them. Mary's song in Luke 1. Some of it's quoted by the narrator at the end of the movie, but look what she sings about. It's revolutionary. I'm bursting with God's news. I'm dancing the song of my Savior God. God took one good look at me and look what happened. I'm the most fortunate woman on earth. What God has done for me will never be forgotten. The God whose very name is holy, set apart from all others. His mercy flows in wave after wave on those who are in awe before him. He bared his arm and showed his strength, scattered the bluffing braggarts. He knocked tyrants off of their high horses, pulled victims out of the mud. The starving poor sat down to a banquet. The callous rich were left out in the cold. He embraced his chosen child, Israel. He remembered and piled on mercies, piled them on high. It is exactly what he promised, beginning with Abraham, right up to now. That's the kind of stuff I think that would connect with today's audience, giving insight into why the birth of Christ was so important and why the story is inspiring. But we get too caught up in our own inward-looking culture, and it affects our storytelling. Rick Warren, when he tells about surveying the community before he started Saddleback, overwhelmingly found in the survey that no one said they didn't believe in God. They just didn't believe in church. I told that to some of my Jewish friends, and they said they believe in their church and the community. Their traditions give them comfort and strength. She said, we just don't believe in God. We need to unravel our Christian culture and our standards from our faith in and our desire to follow Christ. Christianity is not just about being a nice person and G-rated movies. That can be part of it, but it's not necessarily what we're called to. George Barna refers to these new kinds of Christians as revolutionaries, and Irwin McManus of Mosaic calls us to be barbarians. So how do we do this? How do we get these stories to connect? How do we become better storytellers, master storytellers? The Bible has 500 or 600 stories. It should be a part of our DNA as followers of Jesus and readers of the Bible. And I personally think a lot about this in terms of what my calling is in the next 10 years. And the model of filmmaking I want to leave behind is not the example of movies like Left Behind. part of working on this is choosing right stories. And we have some rich literature that has not come to the screen yet, and stories from many cultures and histories that can speak with relevance today. But maybe there's something else behind choosing the right material. Why do we do this? What motivates our storytelling? What motivates those artists? Passion about telling stories and doing it well might be a clue. I don't know how many of you saw the movie Walk the Line, but it's a story about a guy who has failed. Johnny Cash has failed repeatedly. He's desperate. He's cornered a record producer, and he's been trying to write songs all with no result. And finally, he coerces a record producer to give him a chance. And I want you to watch this clip and see what you notice about this.
Thank you.
It's about being passionate, passionate about wanting to succeed. And the subtext, this song becomes the turning point in his career and his life and his band. And he was missing the point with the audience until he sang about what he cared about. A lot of people come to me and have scripts and say this is, you know, something that they want to see get made into a movie. Or want to write a script and ask, you know, what's the best way to go about that? And one of the things that I say to people is, you have to write a script that is going to move you. If your script doesn't change your life, if it's not something that is that you are passionate about, that makes you cry, that makes you laugh, that makes you want to change, why am I going to be affected by it? In the church, we seemingly have lost some of these cultural battles, but we can still be pockets of resistance. I think we need to be storytellers with excellence. We have to go at it as masters. We have to do it with integrity. How we do it and how we are passionate about it matters, because we are people of the faith on the journey. We are not people of the end result only. We are about the process. We are about the relationships. We are about the journey. It matters. And it's about marketability. It's about what's going to reach an audience. So it brings me to reflect on how I operate as a Christian in Hollywood. I frequently get asked, how can you work in that godless marketplace of Hollywood? Isn't it a brothel? Maybe. But many people work in an environment of backbiting and sniping and shoving past each other to get to the front of the line. Oh, wait, that's the church. How about folks who work or live in a place where money drives every decision, deadlines are unrealistic, and the pressure is unrelenting? That's academia, sorry. So maybe your work environment is just shot through with an obsession about sex, who's sleeping with whom, who's gay, who's not. That's the church again. Kind of depends on your perspective, doesn't it? Does Hollywood lack a moral compass? You bet. Are there artists who want to be better people, who want to nurture their families, who want to make better and good value films and television? You bet. That's what makes crew members come up and offer an encouraging word, knowing it has meaning and not just to score points with the producer. Or a film exec that seeks out a friend, asking them to pray for his dad, wanting to find peace in a relationship. Is it hard to fight the prevailing values of the age, what seems right to many? Finding the root of who you are and applying that drills down to the very core of who we are inside. And standing with that value, attempting to make a living at it, or trying not to reflect the prevailing attitudes, is hard work. Whether you slog out a script you're trying to sell in Hollywood, or if you want to change the mindset of how to reach a new generation of students in youth ministry, or you want to inspire the unchurched to come hear the good news of God's coming kingdom. We labor side by side in different marketplaces, but with the same goal of reflecting the incredible love gift we've been given, inviting others to dine at the table where Jesus is putting up more place settings every day. As filmmakers, I think we have some important responsibilities in all of this. My friend Bishop Ken Ulmer says that we all have an assignment. In John 17, he points out that Jesus says, I've glorified you and done the work that you gave me to do. He's completed his assignment, down to the last detail, it says in the message. Well, how do we live our lives with a sense of assignment? You might be the closest thing to the kingdom in a meeting about a movie if you live as if you're on assignment. As filmmakers, we are the teaching pastors of the next generation. I think that's our assignment. And movies are the new sermons. The culture gathers weekly for worship, for 2 hours in a dark room to hear an inspiring story, get charged up for the next week, and talk about it at the water cooler in the office on Monday. And that happens in a multiplex in a theater, not in a sanctuary or a synagogue. George Barna's research shows that 2 hours after a sermon, most people cannot remember the theme of the sermon. But months after seeing a film, audiences can quote lines from the movie. That's an incredible responsibility. How do we be tactical and strategic about applying these skills? Part of it is selection of material, finding stuff that's commercial that an audience wants to see. Your personal stories may turn you on, but who else wants to see it? Who will finance it? And how will it connect at a deep level? I constantly see scripts and stories that maybe, you know, my mother might applaud, but I'm not sure anyone else is dying to see it. My role as a producer is to find the shortest path from the material to the screen, What is the audience reading? What are they watching? What are they talking about in the culture? What are the issues of the time? Who is speaking to those? What are the connections the culture is dying for? What are the timeless stories that address those desires? What am I passionate about? At my company, we're picking and going after material we see the culture responding to. For 10 years, we've been optioning Screwtape Letters. We know how widely sold and beloved the book is, and now we have Walden, the estate, and a distributor interested in funding and making the movie. With my partners at Namesake, we've optioned the Charles Williams novels, the other primary member of the Inklings, looking to transform his novels into movies. He's more obscure than Tolkien or Lewis, but we're betting on leveraging that and tell some of his dark stories. We've optioned several Ted Decker novels, supernatural thrillers. And we're pursuing the same with The Purpose-Driven Life, not an obvious narrative choice, but it sold 35 million copies, and not many of those sold within the studios. Matter of fact, most studios are unaware that this book has outsold The Da Vinci Code and that it's never been reviewed. Yet Hollywood actors and writers are reading this. Or Redeeming Love, I mentioned before, by Francine Rivers. Again, a tremendous following of readers. We are working to find a distributor and set that up. And I think we're just scratching the surface. These are just titles that come into our field of vision based on our relationships and, frankly, without looking that hard. Now, added on top of this is a changing landscape that offers new ways of storytelling. So in my spare time, I have a commercial production company in Santa Monica with my two partners, and we're passionate about the future, experimenting in branded entertainment, the future of advertising. Consumers are worn out with a 30-second spot while TiVo and other recording devices are growing. No one wants something pushed on them. It's even hard for me to remember the last time I watched a live television show. And I want to show you what some of those new ideas look to stimulate some of that thinking. How to provide entertainment without the obvious sell, but creating a story that engages and creates an emotional connection with the product, all the while providing some fun. Not infomercials, not driving content, but entertainment and storytelling. So here are two clips from other filmmakers. Cut them down a little bit, but they're passionate filmmakers just telling stories. This is 250,000 Super Bowls in San Francisco. There are no visual effects in here. It's by Sony, just selling color TVs. Now, it doesn't have to be in English. Thank you. only a passionate filmmaker would go and try to convince the city of San Francisco to throw 250,000 Super Bowls down the street. Well, all of those cultural and media landscapes are being ripped apart right now, and it's a little like the wild, wild west for the entertainment business. Paramount bought DreamWorks, but watch how DreamWorks is making all the hits and nearly runs the place. The artists of DreamWorks are showing up against the agents and business gurus. Disney bought Pixar, but watch how Steve Jobs is going to inherit Walt's mantle and authority. And only 2 years ago, Apple's iTunes offered Lost and Desperate Housewives for their new video iPod, and they downloaded 8 million downloads in 2 months. Hollywood was stunned. And since then, there's been a scramble of mergers and alliances and offerings, and the revolution has been actually going on for a while. It's just that Hollywood recognized it. There are thousands of websites where kids and adults are uploading their videos, their creations, their stories, and their passions. That's what created Brokeback to the Future. By the way, you can also find Top Gun Brokeback Squadron, The Empire Brokeback, Brokeback Dumb and Dumber, Spongeback Mountain, or for the computer crowd, Broke Mac Mountain, with a kid staring blank-eyed into the face of an iMac, frustrated, tapping on his computer mouse, uttering the line that was the film's famous phrase, "I wish I knew how to quit you." These films are being made because the tools are so available and so easy to use. My son-in-law's grandfather loves telling me how he's using an Apple's iMovie to create his own films. He's 75. It's not just about kids. There are short film contests now where you can shoot the film on your cell phone and people compete for those short films. The selection of material we work on reflects who we think the audience is and how we view the audience. And as Christians, our choices say a lot about what we believe. Too often we continue to harp on the same issues of homosexuality and abortion, continuing to dig the same places and only making larger holes. And I think we're missing some opportunities that I think are right in front of us. For instance, why are Christians not making more documentaries about health care and clean water and education and human rights? What's funny to me is that nearly all of our missionaries are doing that. If missionaries are doing and working on all those issues that get attention on the front pages, why aren't we giving them video cameras in our churches and getting filmmakers in our church to edit and shape those stories? It benefits the missionaries. It benefits the community. It trains our filmmakers. And it's your built-in stewardship video if you're worried about that. Our little church in Montrose, where I live, is doing this with very little resources and making an impact. Short films as evangelism. This area has the potential to explode. Mosaic, the church that Erwin McManus leads, has a short film called Select Fit. Made for $3,000, Campus Crusade in Europe now uses this with this DVD and interviews and discussion to use it as a pre-evangelistic tool. Since the European church has sort of failed and lost a connection with the youth, they're using short films to try to reconnect. We could be doing the same things. Podcasts and vlogs. 18 months ago, a site called Rocket Boom in New York gave out their opinions and editorials about the day's news. 3 minutes, free on iTunes, 9 o'clock, Monday through Friday. It cost them $20 a day to do it. And their website showed you how to do it if you wanted to do it yourself. They sold advertising and their banners on eBay for $1 million. Are we even podcasting our sermons? Again, this little church in Montrose I go to is podcasting. Somebody gave me a cassette tape of a sermon the other day, and I honestly don't know what to do with it. I don't have anything in my car or my home that plays a cassette. I just don't understand. And documentaries. I think Christians who want to be filmmakers should not neglect documentaries. The presence of Christians in this area is nearly void. They can be made for less than $500,000, probably the catering budget on an X-Men, and they can openly address issues and agendas of the artist. And finally, I think when we look around at what is connecting with the culture and find a way to see how that can be a pointer to the kingdom. If we are only looking at our media and films and Hollywood as an evangelistic tool or a harmful entertainment provider, we will miss the discussion and the dialogue that is raging in our culture. Isn't that the point? Engaging and cultivating relationships? Do we as evangelicals want Hollywood to convert the masses? Think again. Study George Barna's data. Less than 0.1% accepted Christ as a result of seeing the Passion. But 250 million people were talking about it. Let's make art that engages culture in a meaningful dialogue and pursue truth. The audience wants this dialogue, and if it's presented in a compelling way, they will crave it. Heroes is my new favorite TV show. I should be the number one fan working on Star Trek and working on X-Men, and I'm sort of pissed that I didn't invent it. But it connects with a culture in a deep way. Why am I here? What is true? Am I special? Do I fit in? Should I fit in? Here's a TV show that has a character from Mumbai as a lead protagonist and Japanese characters that don't speak English. So we're watching subtitles on network television. It's truly a different world. Let's watch these clips and see what's being offered. Now, this is from the pilot. Let's just watch some of these. He thinks he has a special power of teleporting, and I love that our Japanese hero is named Hero. He's last on the sports field, but no longer a loser. He doesn't have to be. You don't understand. I want to be special. Superhero. Save the cheerleader, save the world. Well, thanks for inviting me. I hope this has stimulated some good discussion, and I think we might do some questions if you want. Just have me yell out. Then again, maybe you don't have a question.
You mentioned that you were doing street tape later.
Yes.
And I was wondering how you're going to make that into a movie.
I don't know yet. No, it's, you know, there's, it's not a complete narrative. It's little snippets of a relationship, and so that's what a writer does. So what we've been talking about is pitching a narrative structure that would weave those things together about temptation, about Wormwood, about the patient, about Screwtape, giving advice. And there's lots of different ways it can go. As you can tell from tonight, I'm a little more interested in the dark, satirical humor of that, not the Adam Sandler humor of it. And it's going to be hard. It's a big responsibility to take that work of literature and try to adapt it to the screen. And we all feel the weight of that responsibility. The question you should be asking, actually, is how are you going to do the purpose-driven life as a movie? That's even harder. But again, it's similar. We're looking at stories of how people's lives have been impacted in that and try to, you know, reverse engineer that into stories. Well, there's a couple of different ways. I think there's plenty of film festivals. If you have material that is compelling, I think you can get attention at those film festivals. And I think, as in particular, if you are addressing issues that the rest of the culture is concerned about, you'll get attention. So there's a wide variety of ways, from using the internet to networking to I think primarily using those film festivals as venues to showcase your work and see who pays attention, see who salutes it. Yeah. It's coming along fine. Now, we're 8 weeks from shooting. We'll be in Sydney. We're tweaking the script right now and trying to get it out for next summer. So it's... mild panic has set in, actually, in terms of what we have to do and accomplish. But Hugh Jackman is down there doing a movie right now with Baz Luhrmann and Nicole Kidman, and he'll be available mid-November, and we'll start as soon as he's available. So it'll be a fun... It's not X-Men 4, it's Wolverine 1. It's an origin story about Wolverine, and it has all those things in the comic book that you like. Yes? Sure. I think primarily you want to pursue your craft to be the best actor that you can be. And all of the tools and, you know, that are out there and resources and networking that you can do to become the best artist in portraying characters that you can do. I think you'll find your limits in terms of what you do and don't want to do inside of that. And I think you can network with others who believe what you believe to help find those boundaries. But I would urge you to pursue your art form first. That's what's going to get you a hearing. That's what's going to get you attention. And that's what you should focus on. Yes.
I really appreciate coming. I want to say, I graduated college this
Yeah. No. Just kidding. I'm kidding. No, look, I think that... Could be why God invented Starbucks. I don't know. I think that, look, it's a tool. It's a tool that we need to dialogue with people about. Humans have been telling stories around a campfire forever. Why? To entertain, to learn. It's how the youth understand what is important, what lasts, what is value, what gets passed down. So, to me, there's nothing more exciting than an opening night, and I'm like a little kid when a movie opens and the room is full. Everyone's there to enjoy themselves and be entertained. It's the same in going to the theater. It's the same in, you know, television can be sort of a medium like video games that isolates you a little bit. So watch it with your friends. If you're a parent, you ought to be watching television with your kids. I can tell you for a fact, I work with Steven Spielberg. He watches television with his kids. He doesn't let them watch it alone. He watches with them and talks to them about the shows. You know, it's how we engage and use those tools and use that medium. I don't know of any tricks, you know. It's serving a different purpose then, I think.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It depends on the picture. It depends on, you know, sometimes you do movies to get a paycheck and put bread on the table. And sometimes you do the movie for no money because you believe in what you're doing. So it depends. I can't answer that question with an exact percentage on every movie. I do think... You know, there's an impact being made by the very presence of being a Christian in that industry, in the way you deal with people and treat people. That makes a difference because I strongly believe that it's about the process. It's how we get there to the end result as well as it is about the end result. So I think it depends on the project. It shifts on different projects. I think there's an education process in the church, is what I've hinted at in here, is in terms of, you know, separating what it means to be a Christian and follow Christ and what it means to be, you know, a good citizen and have good values. And sometimes those coincide and sometimes they don't. A lot of things that Jesus talks about are revolutionary and are hard to hear. And, you know, you got a guy like Moses and hears voices and hears people talking to him. We'd throw people like that into jail today. Those people, that doesn't make any sense. So I think it's an education process in trying to do that. And one of the churches I was at before when I was in town more, I haven't been in town much, trying to do Sunday school classes that you know, at Oscar time. Let's review in January, let's look at the 5 movies that are nominated for being Best Picture. And let's do that as a Sunday school class. And let's look at that. Your assignment this week is to go out and watch that movie, whatever it is, and then we're going to talk about it, open our Bible and say, what's that movie about? What are the values that it reflects? And now how does that match up against what we believe in the Bible? Are there some pointers and things we can learn from that? Or is it going against the grain? I had a big class. Who doesn't want to have a homework assignment going to see a movie? But as there's an education process, I think, of trying to get very practical. And if you're a youth minister, you know, doing that in a very practical way. Listen to music. Well, let's tear apart those words. What is it saying? What's that about? And a lot of times it's not very discerning in the way we consume culture. So we can be more discerning and more educating about that, I think. Yes.
So what exactly is the
That's the directors' union that is who represents them and negotiates their salaries and bargains for them in Hollywood. There's probably a website you can go to and get more information about that. Yes. Sure.
My passion is to find accurate sources for storyline development. This world seems polarized when it comes to information sources. Somewhere there's a blog or a radio or television news analysis. Personality can support whatever narrow view of this world and various societies that one may want to believe. What suggestions might you have for this group here on ways to objectively define what it is?
It's a good question, and I think it's difficult to sift through in terms of all the websites and newspaper sources and all that and find out what the truth is. That's what journalists are about, and I think, you know, people gravitate to different journalists who they like their methods, their methodology, their sources, the way they go about it, and so some people are attracted to the New York Times and the way stories get reported and dug into and things that are unearthed. And I think everybody appreciates those kind of stories that can come at it from an unbiased point of view or as unbiased as they can be. And that's kind of the problem, isn't it? And, yeah, it is the problem. And so we tend to line up with our political views and our religious views, et cetera. And it's tricky. We have to be discerning. And I think, you know, it's hard to do that by yourself as well. Sure. Yeah. Sure. That's why documentaries get made that support Bill Clinton and documentaries get made that attack Bill Clinton. So, you know, you've got to sort of weigh all those things and do some. It depends on how much you value that information and how much research you're going to do to dig down and say, what is the truth and what am I willing to do to find the truth? Yeah. Good. I mean, they're okay with it. They know who I am, and I don't wear it on my sleeve. I have a Bible in my office, but I don't keep it on my desk and keep it open and read passages to people when they come in. But they know who I am. And, you know, there's people that are okay with it and people that just don't want to talk about it. And I don't get invited to those parties, and that's okay. I'm a happy guy. Thank you.